Good to see everyone out this morning. It's great to have visitors with us. We're going to continue our study of the major archetypes in the Bible with the series, The Bible If You Haven't Read Yet. Today, we're going to talk about a couple of mountains. A couple of mountains that represent a lot to both to the Old Testament and what eventually became the New Testament. Who's the greatest lawbreaker in Israel? When you look in your Bible in the Old Testament, who could you find that would be the greatest one? David, maybe? Someone might name him or someone else. Well, it was Moses, because he broke all 10 at one time. Mount Sinai is the mountain Moses received the law from God, where he got the 10 commandments, which he was so upset about that he broke and had to have more made. It represents the fear that they had as Moses was on the mountain and the lightning and the thunder flashed around them. That's the image that, you know, many people even have today. A fear of God in the lightning that was out there. A fear of what lay on top of that mountain. That most imposing structure that we have on this earth. Moses went up there. And in their fear, even with their fear, they still managed to start worshiping another god. They thought Moses had met his end up there and that they needed to start appeasing other people. In Leviticus, chapter 26, verse 46, these are the statutes and ordinances and laws which the Lord established between himself and the sons of Israel through Moses at Mount Sinai. Or in Romans 7:5, for while we were in the flesh, the sinful passions, which were aroused by the law, were at work in the members of our body to bear fruit for death. For the law, in Romans 8:2, for the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set you free from the law of sin and death. And finally, in 1 Corinthians 15:56, the sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. The most interesting verse out of these is Romans 7:5, where it says that or aroused by the law. Now, why are people aroused by the law? People have a rebellious nature to themselves. If you look at a lot of the movies that we have, we see a lot of rebellion. In the 70s, the chase movies became so popular, and with the good guys, which were kind of bad, but not too bad, were chased by the lawmen, some of them bad, some of them inept. And I guess it really goes back to the Keystone Cops, where they were chasing lawbreakers. But there's an ideal that people look to of breaking the law. And in the book, Illustrations of a Bible Truth, by H.A. Arnside, he wrote this in this book, and I've just found it so great and interesting. He said, some years ago, I had a little school for young Indian men and women who came to my home in Oakland, California, from the various tribes in northern Arizona. One of these was a Navajo man of unusually keen intelligence. One Sunday evening, he went with me to our young people's meeting. They were talking about the epistle to the Galatians, and the special subject was law and grace. They were not very clear about it. And finally, one turned to the Indian and said, I wonder whether our Indian friend has anything to say about this. He rose to his feet and said, well, my friends, I have been listening very carefully because I am here to learn all I can in order to take it back to my people. I do not understand all that you are talking about, and I do not think you do yourself. But concerning this law and grace business, let me see if I can make it clear. I think it is like this. When Mr. Ironside brought me from my home, we took the longest railroad journey I'd ever took. We got out to Barstow, and there I was sitting in the most beautiful railroad station and hotel I'd ever seen. I walked around and saw at one end a sign, Do Not Spit Here. I looked at the sign and then looked down on the ground and saw that so many had spit there before. And I was thinking, you know, what I'm doing here, I spit myself. Isn't it strange when a sign says, do not spit here, that we're compelled to spit, he says. I come to Oakland, and I go to the home of the lady who invited me to dinner today, and I am in the nicest home I've ever been in. Such beautiful furniture and carpets, I hate to step on them. I sank into a comfortable chair, and the lady said, now, John, you sit there while I go out and see whether the maid has made dinner ready. I look around at the beautiful pictures, at the grand piano, and I walk around all those rooms, and I'm looking for a sign. And the sign I'm looking for is, do not spit here. But I look around these two beautiful drawing rooms and can't find a sign like this. I think, what a pity, when this is such a beautiful home, to have people spitting all over it. Too bad they don't put up a sign, he said. So I look at all the carpet, but can't find anywhere where anyone has spit on the floor. What a queer thing, he said. Where the sign says, do not spit, a lot of people spit. Where there was no sign at all in this beautiful home, nobody spit it. Now I understand that sign is law, but inside the home it is grace. They love their beautiful home and they want to keep it clean. They do not need a sign to tell them so. I think that explains the law and grace business. As he sat down, a murmur of approval went around the room and the leader exclaimed, I think that is the best illustration of law and grace I have ever heard. And it appealed to me because law magnifies sin. Law causes people to want to rebel. And that's what they got on Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai, where the law was given, is a metaphor that represents the mountain of sin that weighs on each and every one of us today. It's a burden too large for each one of us to carry and too obvious for us to ignore. What can we do to release ourselves from this burden? What can we do to put ourselves in the good graces of God? Well, in Genesis 22, verse 2, he said, now take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains on which I tell you. Now this is kind of familiar because we did a sermon about Abraham and Isaac's sacrifice. But we did nothing to mention the other archetype, which is this mountain. Mount Sinai, that represents the law, and Mount Moriah, which represents place of grace. In 2 Chronicles 3:1, then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David at the place David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite. This mount then had witnessed the offering sacrifice of Isaac, the vision of God's judgment and mercy, the presence of his temple, and worship, and of course, the crucifixion, because Jesus was crucified just outside those walls. David had prevailed in a number of his battles with his enemies of Israel. In 1 Chronicles chapter 21 tells us about that. In verses 1 through 6, it gives us the account of David ordering a census of the people of the kingdom. It says, Satan caused David to give in to the desire to know the true strength of his kingdom. You wonder, well, what's the census? The census is a good thing. We do it every 10 years. We realign our congressional districts. We determine where people live. We determine some of the attitudes and things that are happening with people. We kind of take a pulse of the nation. So what's bad about that? Well, David numbered his men to know his physical strength, his worldly strength. He wasn't trusting in God to provide. Now the Israelites had prevailed over many a battle, where they were the lesser in number, where they overcame their enemies. And David's mistake was he was beginning to trust into the world. If I knew those house-to-house, heart-to-hearts would be useful for something, but I was thinking maybe something a little different. Anyway, David's mistake was that he began to trust in this world. The number of soldiers he had, and he had a lot, he had 1,000,007 or what have you, soldiers. He had raised quite a large army. But God never won these battles with these great armies. Instead of trusting God to defeat his enemies, he began to look at worldly means available to him to wage battle. Now, we don't want to fault David too much because we're kind of that same way. It never fails. We see God deliver us from one crisis to the other crisis in our lives. And we see how he worked things out, and we praise him and we bless him. And what happens when that next bad time comes? We start to worry. We start to wonder about things. And of course, I guess, you know, it's human nature to wonder about what's going to happen to you when something awful is happening to you or some loved one or something like that. But we kind of fall back into that same thing of trusting ourselves and wondering ourselves and not putting our full weight and trust in the hands of God. It's something I guess we learn over time as Christians become older. They learn to trust and trust more. They have more experience in it. But we need to learn that God will take care of us through everything in life. In verse 7 of 1 Chronicles 21, or was it 22? 21. In verse 7, God was displeased with this thing. So he struck Israel. In verse 8, David said to God, "I have sinned greatly in that I have done this thing, but now please take away this iniquity from your servant, for I have done very foolishly." Verse 9, the Lord spoke to Gad, David's seer, saying, "Go and speak to David, saying, Thus say the Lord, I offer you three things. Choose for yourself one of them, which I will do to you." So Gad came to David and said to him, "Thus saith the Lord, take for yourself either 3 years of famine, or 3 months to be swept away before your foes, while the sword of your enemy overtakes you, or else 3 days of the sword of the Lord, even pestilence in the land, and the angel of the Lord destroying throughout all the territory of Israel. Now, therefore, consider what answer I shall return to him who sent me." David said to Gad, "I am in great distress. Please let me fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man." So the Lord sent a pestilence on Israel. 70,000 men of Israel fell. And God sent an angel to Jerusalem to destroy it. But as he was about to destroy it, the Lord saw and was sorry over the calamity, and said to the destroying angel, "It is enough. Now relax your hand." And the angel of the Lord was standing by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Then David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord standing between earth and heaven, with his drawn sword in his hand stretched out over Jerusalem. Then David and the elders, covered with sackcloth, fell on their faces. David said to God, "It is not I who commanded to count the people. Is it not I who commanded to count the people? Indeed, I am the one who has sinned and done very wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? O my Lord, my God, please let your hand be against me and my father's household, but not against your people, and that they should be plagued." Then the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to say to David, that David should go up and build an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite. Now David bought the place. The man wanted to give it to him, but he bought it. He said it should be paid for. It should be a sacrifice. He realized the cost of his sin. And sin is something that can affect not only ourselves, but others also. And we see here in this story that that's exactly what happened. Mount Moriah once again became a place of sacrifice, faith, mercy, and forgiveness. This is when Isaac's life was spared and Abraham's faith was confirmed. It became a mountain upon which the mercy of the God was there. In Matthew 17:20, "And he said to them, because of the littleness of your faith, for truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." You know, we read that verse and we think, well, you know, about moving mountains. Christ wasn't necessarily talking about moving a physical mountain. He was using a metaphor to the obstacles in their way. Now, mountains, we know we had trouble in the 1800s crossing because of all the mountains, and they sought passages that were shallow and not as high so that they could get around. And I could about imagine when they first explored that territory. When they climbed that mountain and they looked across, and there's a valley and another mountain. And that one looks even taller than this one. I'm sure they were greatly disappointed. But they probably trudged on. Went up that other mountain. And guess what? When they got to the top of that one, there was another valley and another mountain. We face mountains and valleys in our lives. We face the ups and downs. We face the tops of the peaks of the waves and the valleys and the troughs. We face all those things. And when we move mountains in our lives, we move those obstacles out of the way. The obstacles that prevent us from having a full relationship with Christ. And that's what faith does for us. And that's what Mount Moriah means to the people then. And what it should mean for us is that the mountain of sin, the mountain of the law, the burden that we have on our lives, is taken away by the other mountain, the mountain of sacrifice, the mountain of mercy, the mountain where the temple stood. Our mountain where the temple lives today in us. With faith, nothing can stand in your way, not even Mount Sinai. God changed the archetype from the mountain of the law that condemns to the mountain of mercy that saves. You know, according to a 3rd century rabbi, Moses gave 365 prohibitions and 248 positive commands. David reduced them to 11 in Psalms 15. Isaiah made them into 6 in Isaiah 33:14-15. Micah 6:8 binds them into just 3 commands. And Habakkuk reduces them to only one great statement. The just shall live by faith. This mount, Mount Moriah, witness to the crucifixion of Christ. In the shadow of that mount, Jesus died for you and me. Now that mountain represents all that we have in this life. That mount represents the mercy that we have from God. That when we climb to the top of the mountain, there we'll find peace. There we'll find happiness. There we can rest contented in those things. Because we're not under the law anymore. We're not under the law that just magnifies the sin in our lives. It makes it more abundant that we haven't gained forgiveness, but that we're following the law until the Messiah comes. And then the Messiah comes, and he gets crucified in the shadow of the temple. That mountain seen it all, Mount Moriah. God changed from the law to grace, and we're the more better for it. We're better for these things that we have. We're better because we don't have to worship underneath the law. We don't have to follow all these edicts and everything in there. And while they only had those in the Bible, there were a lot more added by the people of the nation of Israel after that. They had countless things they had to observe. Countless laws and rules and everything like that. What a burden. Jesus comes and lifts that burden from us. He takes that mountain of sin off of us and gives us the mountain of mercy. I don't think anything could be better than that in our lives. I don't know what your condition is this morning or what your needs might be, but if you have need of the church, won't you come as we stand and sing the song of invitation?